made the mass spectrometer tube, the actual tube, and then we made the magnets and lined up everything. And I'm sure you read this too, but he was going to come down and show us how to, you know, how to run it and test it and so on. Well, gosh, I got a call from him, and he said, I can't come, and he's going to send down a guy named Ed Nye, who was a good graduate student. I know him now. He's in the National Academy and so on. And then I got a call and said, Nye can't come. And they finally sent an undergraduate student down there to work with us. And we worked, during the Christmas holidays, we worked our fannies off. We couldn't get that damn thing to work. And, well, they had an electrometer tube in a casing that was supposed to be under vacuum. But I thought our machine shop, I looked at that thing and I thought our machine shop didn't make this properly. We don't dare put this under vacuum. And so we put the calcium chloride in there and so on to take up the water. And finally I said, well, Jesus, it must be that you got to have that drier than we're getting it. So we put it under vacuum and this damn case just caved right in and broke it. And so my wife was up in Minneapolis where folks lived there, so I drove home that holiday and so on. And then, as I say, I went over to see Neer, and it all changed. I couldn't get in his lab. I couldn't get downstairs. There were policemen around there with guns, and what's going on here? I had no idea. You see, he was in the Manhattan Project and making this U-235 for the test, first test for this would make an atomic bomb. And then he told us that we couldn't get electrometer tubes. They were all requisitioned. Well, as it turned out, Krampitz went over and found one in the physics building, and we finally got the thing working. He did two things that were very detrimental to us, kind as he was. He figured we didn't know how to do things, so he was going to make them so we couldn't follow it up. Well, this mass spectrometer's got a filament that's heated electrically and platinum, and it shoots the electrons across and ionizes the gas. And that's got to be lined up right across the plates that with the slits in where the beam goes through that have got the charge on. So they made that thing with a couple of brackets that you slip this in with some prongs sticking out. And then when you got, if your filament burned out, you had to slip it into there so you'd have it lined up right. Well, it turned out, well, in the first place, we found out what was wrong was that the magnet was wound the opposite of what we thought. You see, they wound the damn thing, then they tied it, and they went like this. And when we looked in, we thought, okay, it's one like this, and so we hooked it up that way. And after weeks, we worked on that thing night and day for, I'll bet you, weeks before we... And finally I decided, well, we've done everything. There's nothing more. It's got to be this cockeyed magnet. So we tore the paper off, and sure enough, all we did was just change those poles, and the thing worked immediately. But you were supposed to bake it out to get all to degas it. You were supposed to bake this thing out. You heated it and so on. Well, the trouble is, when you heated that thing, these prongs that were sticking here, this thing expanded like that, and it shorted this thing out. Well, we'd have the thing working, and then we'd think, okay, let's bake her out. We'd bake it out. Wouldn't work. And we must have taken that filament off and put it on and taken it off dozens of times almost. the glass got so defrosted because of your re-blowing it and so on, that we had to put in a new piece in there and whatnot. And then it finally dawned on me, damn it all, let's take those prongs off of there. Took the prongs off and worked immediately. He said, well, that screwed us up. Then when he made the thermal diffusion column, the way his was, he had a big pipe up at the top, and then it went down into a smaller pipe, and so on. So the first 12 feet or so was this great big pipe. And he thought, well, these guys, that's going to be hard for them to work with this big pipe. We'll make two columns coming down like this, and then we'll make a collar, and then we'll go down. Well, that was a fatal mistake, too. Because if these two didn't get heated exactly the same, it just made a chimney. And so when we started this up, the isotopes went up for a little while, C13. We had a mass spectrometer so we could analyze it. And then it wouldn't go anymore. And I finally figured out, well, just by logic, if that cockeyed thing isn't exactly the same. So we cut the one piece right off, and then it went right up. But that held us up, too. Every time he tried to save us time, he made us... But he was very, very kind to us, you know, in this regard. And, of course, this was extremely fortunate for me, because I got a reputation of working with isotopes in the early days, and Muir told me, he said, you know, I gave tubes to, during this time, which was during the war, to about 12 people. And he said, most of them were physicists. He says, you're the only guy that ever got it to work. We only got it to work because we were so damn stubborn. Of course, it was a simple one. It had B batteries, so all the 20 of them hooked across so that you didn't have an electronic stuff to monkey with it and so on. He specially designed that, which worked. But when I went up to Minnesota, these guys were all gone. All the physicists were in the Manhattan Project. And they had all these mass spectrometers sitting down there, none of them working. And I find, and of course, they were all on these electronic stuff, which I couldn't run. And I finally got some guy that knew something about it, and we got one of them going and did this isotope experiments there with the physiologists. We worked on glycogen and Baird Hastings had shown that, and so that started us, and then we decided we could determine which of the six carbons the isotope was in. We'll use the bacteria to ferment it, lactic bacteria, so that we got it degraded that way. And we were able to show that it fit the Krebs cycle and stuff like that.
When, am I correct in understanding that when you built both the diffusion column and the mass spectrometer, that it was your group that was doing it? Did you have much assistance from physics?
We did it entirely.
You did it entirely by yourself?
Yeah, the graduate students and me, I wasn't a graduate student, but we did the whole damn thing. Silver soldered it all away and everything else, which, you know, today, I'd like to see you get a bunch of graduate students and postdoc to build that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a tremendous undertaking. But
how long did it take?
Oh, I don't know. Well, I imagine it took several months at least for the mass spectrometer. It's interesting. I went to Ames to receive achievement award, I guess, at Iowa State. And they told me that this tube, that mass spectrometer tube was in the institute there now.
Really?
Yeah. I suppose it's down in some hole somewhere, but it was that unique as far as being in a biological. Well, there weren't very many mass spectrometers anywhere.
No, not at all.
NIR, of course, was extremely helpful in this regard. Geez, I always remember I went up there and he sat me down in front of the mass spectrometer and said, now you turn this dial and you see this galvanometer move across here and you change the voltage and then you see what the C13 is compared to the C12. And it got to be about 5:30 and he said, well, I got to go home. But you sit here and just monkey with this thing. He said, just don't open up the cox and let some oxygen in. Just, here's this piece of machinery I'd never seen before. And he said, oh, you can't do any damage. And a lot of guys wouldn't even let you touch it. And it was the same when I said, well, you think we can make one? Oh, sure, no problem. A lot of guys would have said, no, that's impossible. He said, no, we'll get one. We'll get a tube made here, and you guys go down there. And I didn't know anything about electrical circuits or a damn thing. I just went up and drew pictures of his circuits without understanding them almost. So, but that story about how the thermal diffusion column, you know, where we had to push the water up five stories. Well, we got the crazy thing built, and pretty soon we got it so it was working pretty good. And then one morning I came in and this damn thing was just all worked out of shape. And pretty well knew that the water must have turned off or something, because you see this inside would be heated and then the cold, but if your cold wasn't on, then these things would get hot and expand. So by that time, of course, we knew pretty. We got it fixed pretty soon, and then I was working in a lab where I could hear the water coming, and every once in a while I'd notice it slow down. What's going on here? Why is it? And it turned out that I finally figured out that this is when the nurses had their, or the home economics gals had their classes over there. So we went up in the toilet at night, and they had three of them there. You could flush two of them, and the water pressure would stay up all right, but if you flushed all three simultaneously. So I would go to workmen and tell them, get rid of one of those toilets up there. So they finally put in a separate line with a pressure gauge on it and so on. And that kind of thing, he would, you know, he'd go get it and so on. We didn't have any grants or anything, but somehow he
did
got.
Did he do any experimental work himself, or was he?
No, he never did an experiment while I was there. He was pretty good about getting equipment and stuff like that, but he didn't do it. He did a fair amount of reading, and there's a hell of a lot of professors that don't do any experiments too. It's not unusual, and so on. So you couldn't really fault him on that. What you could fault him on was that he probably. I don't think he was at the forefront of what was going on in his labs in some respects, and so on. Because he really, you see, I was there. Murdoch was there, who was came here and got in the National Academy. Krampus was there, who got in the National. He had three guys there, plus some others, who were damn good. And when he kicked me out, he just ruined that whole team. And he had a team there that we couldn't have missed.
Did the others leave too?
Yeah, well, when I went up to Minnesota, Ida came up with me a year afterwards. And when I came down here, Krampus came with me. Krampus was stuck there, just, you know, things had gone to pot within 3 years. And he hired a guy, what was his name? Anyway, he was a pretty eminent biochemist. And I got a letter from him about a year or so ago. Well, I wrote Then and Now, and he saw Then and Now, and then he sent me some stuff. He said, you were awful charitable to workmen. And I said, well, I don't know. I wasn't so charitable. But then he wrote about his problems. By that time, he was getting grants and so on. He said, I never could spend any of the money, even for my own grants and so on. And, of course, that kind of thing ran the place down.
Going back chronologically, I was curious about one thing. You, it wasn't until 1939, you went back to Iowa State in 36, it wasn't until 39 that you learned about the carbon-11 availability.
Yeah, so about that time.
What were you doing in that three-year period? Just continuing more of the...
We're working our fanny off trying to figure out how to show where that CO2 was and so on. And I did show that if you put in sodium fluoride, it stopped the succinic formation, and it also stopped simultaneously CO2 fixation. So it all fit together. But to really nail it down exactly where that went, there was no way. And so when the isotopes came available, this opened up a whole new ball game. And of course, we knew what we wanted to look for. You know, we knew exactly which compound and so on. It was kind of funny. I got propionic acid out of those fermentations, and I never did anything with it. I just stuck it in the fridge and froze it up. Well, Martin Kamen and Barker and these guys took the propionic acid and they degraded it. They did it in a... They oxidized with permanganate and got oxalate out, and they showed the oxalate had the isotope in it as well as the CO2. And so they said that the isotope was in all three carbons. Boy, I was just mortified. I thought, my God, here I sit with that propionic acid in there, and I don't even have enough sense to degrade it and look at it. Well, and the other thing they did is they made the barium carbonate, the barium salt, and they pyrolyzed it. And that goes to ethylene. This is ethylene, these are acetylene, and CO2. And they both fit. That it was all, part of it was in the CO2 and part of it was in that. So I thought, well, these guys have not really shown which one, it's in the carboxyl, but they haven't shown whether it's equal in the alpha and the beta positions, and I better find out about that. And I remember I went over to see Henry Gilman to talk to him about how to degrade this propionic acid. Well, we treated with bromine and brominated the alpha position and converted it to lactic acid, and then we got off the CO2 and acetaldehyde, and we got the and did an iodoform reaction, and we got all three carbons separated. So then, and I happened to be there that time. We went. I was up at Neer's place, and we put these samples in. Christ, there was nothing in the methyl group. There was nothing in the alpha position. It was all in the carboxyl position. Well, it just turns out that these guys' degradations was not specific enough. And so the fact that it's in the propionate is because the succinate and propionate are more or less in equilibrium with each other, so that carboxyl group gets in that one. So I got off the hook there. But we, you know, we did a lot of chemistry, degrading these compounds and stuff like that, which I don't know, we don't do anymore. You buy your stuff, you, I don't know. I don't see any chemistry going on of that type. Sure, there's chemistry. First place, you use enzymes to do a lot of it that you would do chemically and that kind of thing.
How rapidly, once you had that facility at Iowa State, were others quick to pick up on that, or did you still were still the few that had that?
It was a long time. You see, they it never really got picked up. C-14 came along and in the 40s, after the Second World War, and carbon 14 is so much easier to use than is carbon 13. You don't have to have as sophisticated equipment and so on. So and there was sort of a rivalry almost between C-13 and C-14 because I don't know. You can do some things with C-13 you can't do with C-14, but on the whole, C-14's got a long half-life, so you can do just about everything that you want to do. So when we came here, we got a mass spectrometer. We made one here, and you could buy C-13 at that time. So, but gradually, it's gone out of use. It's used for nitrogen. Quite a lot of work goes on in Wisconsin where they have studying nitrogen fixation and those kind of things and so on. But in general, it's nitrogen. Well, it's used sometimes now for isotope discrimination. They got 100% C-13 and they see whether there's discrimination in chemical reactions and that kind of thing.
When you went to Minnesota in 43, that was, you were there until the war, after the war was over. What kind of relationship did you have with that department?
No, I had a pretty good relationship. Of course, it was an entirely new experience. I was going and sitting in on neurophysiology and stuff like that because of this type of thing. We were working with monkeys and cotton rats and infecting them, and a whole new ball of wax for me. Our main problem was that Ephraim Lacker had done some experiments with cotton rats that had polio, and he had claimed that the glycolytic pathways were cut way down during polio. So it looked like some enzymes in the brain were influenced by these polio virus. So Vischer wanted me to work on that. So we would infect cotton rats and take out their brains and study glycolysis, the way they form lactic acid and this kind of thing.
Well,
we decided that before we did anything with polio, we better find out how you measure glycolysis in the brain of a normal rat, and what are the standards, sort of. And it turned out that the methods that Rack and them were using wasn't getting anywhere near the capacity of the brain to carry out glycolysis. And so when we did this with cotton rats, unless they were so morbid that they were just there was no effect. So that was our main contribution there. And, we learned something about how to work with animals and how to take out organs and stuff like that. And as a microbiologist, I was traveling in a different group of people, and so I didn't know very much about the eminent biochemists. I knew by paper, but I didn't have any personal contact with them. And of course, this sort of opened up my meeting those people and so on. So we didn't go to any of the Society of Biological Chemistry meetings when I was a graduate student or postdoc and so on. And that got going. So, of course, when I came here, I was head of this department.
How did that change come about? You said that you were reluctant to leave Minnesota and come to Cleveland.
Well, I was. I'm still a little.
Certainly, the deer hunting is better there than it is.
Well, I don't know if it is, but I had my brothers and my dad and so on, and we had a deer camp, and somehow or other, I don't know, I was always so cockeyed busy around here, I never really got going on hunting and fishing in this area. The only way I'd go is if I'd take 2 weeks off and go. That's the way it sort of settled down here. Yeah, I was reluctant to go.
So you weren't really looking. They came.
Oh yeah, they called me.
They came to you.
I know now that they had. I didn't know this for a long time. They had interviewed about two or three people before they got in touch with me. I think Carl Corey put them on to me. Carl. He knew about our work and so on, and so. He apparently told you see, Warren was from the East, and he was going to Harvard and the Eastern schools to find his men. And I think they offered it to Ed Tatum, and I think they offered it to, I don't know for sure on Ed Tatum, but I kind of think so. I think they offered it to a guy at Harvard, Ball. Who didn't take it. I didn't know that until I read a bibliography that Hastings wrote, and he told about Eric Ball being offered this job out here. So that's how it happened, I guess.
Well, what was it then that
made me come here?
Well,
I think I thought, I want to go and set up a department and set it up the way I think it ought to be. And here we got a clean sweep. Nobody's going to be here. We can just set it up and we can run it the way we want to run it. And so I thought, okay, let's go try it. And I guess I probably didn't realize how difficult would be, but in general it worked pretty good because I had a cooperative bunch of young guys working with me who were just as anxious to get things going as I was.
Was the university supportive?
Supportive?
Were they supportive of what you were doing?
Yeah, the fellas? Well, hell, we decided as a team. We voted. And so on. If we're going to set up a new lab, we set up a whole bunch of new labs for medical students. I went around to the schools. Went to Yale and to Harvard and saw what they were teaching. Man, the labs they gave was just, in my opinion, were ridiculous. They were just a bunch of cookbook stuff and they had not much to do with the lectures and so on. And so when we came here, I got busy and we made up, we did some isotope experiments right away. I had to get special permission from the Atomic Energy Commission to do it, and we did some isotope experiments of that type. We made pyroxene diabetes. If they were going to determine the sugar, I wanted them to have a reason to determine the sugar. So